back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and today we are taking a look at the next two chapters in the Squadron Supreme. So that means that Mr. Gene Hendricks is here with me. Good morning, Gene.
Hello, squadmates.
Or good afternoon or good evening, depending on when people are listening to this.
Yes.
And I'm finding more and more that even though this is not his show, I enjoy recording with Mr. Sean Whalen so much that I find I'm inviting him along for the ride way, way more than I ever thought I would. But he's back with us. He's gracious enough to come along. How you doing, Sean?
I appreciate being invited for this one. I've got some history with this book, so I'm glad to be here.
I'm sorry, did you say you do have a history or you don't have a history?
I do.
So why don't you tell us your history? Why don't we ease into this that way?
So I read this as it was coming out. And I don't know how I knew about it. This was freshman year in high school for me when this was released. And I was jumping between Marvel and DC. You know, I had you have no budget at that age for comics. So that's the unique thing about jumping on a maxi series. Comics and Collectibles was a local comic book shop at that time. And that was still early days of having a local. And the cool thing about this one, I don't know how I knew about it. I don't remember if it was like Marvel Age or some of the ads inside one of my Marvel books, but I knew this was coming and I was intrigued by it. The issue hit the shelf and I grabbed the first issue and just really was captivated by it. 12-issue maxi series at the time, covering this kind of material, doing what this book did to the characters in it, we're used to this now. This was not the norm. This is an interesting series to talk about because of the fact that they were, yes, they were guests in Avengers. I didn't know them from that. I knew them from just, I saw this really cool opportunity that to read these interesting, unique new characters that, yes, were Justice League amalgams. I'm a DC geek. So it was like, it was interesting to see Marvel play with that playground. The shackles are off on this book, which you guys were already talking about in episode one. They really screwed with these people.
Yeah.
And with the concept of what you could do with the Justice League, there's ideas that they introduce in this about fears about superheroes and what they could do with these immense powers that we do see companies like DC and Marvel explore with their mainline characters years later. So there's a lot about this that's really cutting edge in what it was doing at that time because of the fact that they did not have to worry about, like, hey, we're doing this to Captain America or Superman. And it's a very interesting book to talk about. So thank you for inviting me to jump on board today for this these two issues. It's been a pleasure reading this. I haven't reread it in years. So some of this does feel like a fresh read. I just have a lot of fond memories of it because of what it did at the time. And also at that age, sticking with a 12-issue maxi series is not as easy as it sounds. Because it had to be a destination to get to the comic shop because you missed it. You were occasionally they'd come back around, but it was very rare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I found there were a huge amount of back issues at the time for it.
Right.
Well, I did have a regular comic shop I was going to at this time that had a pull list, so I did have that. But it was easier if you had a pull list to keep up with something like this for obvious reasons because they'd pull it and save it for you. But it was harder to do it when I was, you know, younger than that when I was getting my books off the newsstand because there were the occasional days where the newsstand just wouldn't have the book that you were requesting. You know, they just didn't, you know. I remember going to different stores and, you know, like if I was in a different neighborhood back in, you know, the mid-70s, say, when I was first getting into comics and, you know, we'd go from Marine Park, where I lived, to Bay Ridge, which is, you know, literally a 15-minute ride. But there'd be another candy store So I would have to say to my parents, well, I'm going to go and look in this candy store. And I'd see books that they didn't have in my store because not every store had every book. So it was definitely easier. By the time this came out, it was easier to keep up with what was coming out than it was when I was, you know, younger. So at this point, I was getting, you know, every book was pulled for me. And this was actually towards the twilight of my collecting, because I felt like I was too old to be a comic collector. I was graduating college, so I can't be reading comic books all the time. Girls may think I'm not cool. So whatever the case may be, it took me. We'll put it this way: I stopped in around 86 because girls might think I'm not cool. And I didn't start again until I was engaged to get married. So I guess there was a correlation there.
That stigma was a thing, very much so. Because especially during this era, this was before like the Batman boom that happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was right before then. Yes, we started having more of the comics that were starting to touch on mature topics and try to explore some of this stuff. But you did not have yet the general populace that was like recognizing that, oh, these stories are interesting. Comics had a strong readership, but it was still the group that read comics. It's really interesting to think back to this time. Like Squadron Supreme was not something that I talked about with anybody, because the impression you always got was nobody would care. That's my realm what it was like back mm-hmm. then. It wasn't until after this, and we're talking about maybe like a year later, that all of a sudden I was talking to people about Batman that I could never talk to comics about. So
yeah, I have to say I'm being a little bit facetious on the reasoning for my stopping. I think I never stopped being a geek, and I still talked about comics and comic heroes and never hid my love for it, and I never got rid of my collection. So anybody who knew me knew what I was into, so I wasn't really trying to hide it. I think if I try to really go to my true motivations, it was probably that I wanted to spend my limited budget on beer instead of comics. Probably more realistic. But I did collect this series when it came out, which Gene and I discussed last time we did this book. And I read it and loved it, and I've sung its praises for years, but it's been a long time since I read it. And I do remember all the major story turns, but I don't remember a lot of the more subtleties and the little things. So I'm enjoying getting a chance to reread it. And much like we did with Camelot 3000, I'm not jumping ahead in my reading. Mm-hmm. I'm reading what we're covering, and then I'm going to leave it until next time when we prep. So I'm really enjoying this. So any more prologue before we get into the synopsis for issue number 2?
I think we're good.
Now I'm ready to see Superman fight Kang.
Okay. Well, you know, the cover makes you think you're going to see Superman fight
right.
Kang. But the story, and we'll talk about that a little bit, the story doesn't really give us that. It does give us what we see on the cover, but we don't see the fight that you anticipate. And mm-hmm. we'll get into that in a moment. Issue number 2 was released on June 25th of 1985 with a cover date of October of 1985. The cover shows the squadron gathered around a meeting table, and then up above the table is the Scarlet Centurion and Hyperion getting ready to square off. And Hyperion is saying, if I can actually move this so that I can read it, if you dare attack Earth now in its darkest hour, Scarlet Centurion, I'll kill you with my bare hands. And they both look like they're ready to just kind of go at each other. So from the cover, you anticipate a big battle there. And if you're up on your comics lore, you know that the Scarlet Centurion is an alternate version of Kang at this point. So we do have that. The story is written by Mark Gruenwald, penciled by Bob Hall, inked by John Beattie, colored by Christy Scheel, lettered by Janice Chang, and edited by the Karate Kid himself, Ralph Macchio. The story is titled A Small Sacrifice. Over Central Sigmund, Dr. Spectrum, Golden Archer, and Tom Thumb deliver food supplies to the populace. While they do so, Tom starts to feel increasingly marginalized. After Spectrum and the Archer give speeches, a group of men posing as councilmen hold the mayor at gunpoint. They make the Archer and Spectrum drop their bow and power prism, respectively. The men make the squadroners line up to be shot, but Spectrum takes control of his prism remotely and uses it to disarm the men before he and the Archer subdue them. Tom, meanwhile, is overlooked throughout. Meanwhile, Nuke goes to see his terminally ill parents in hospital and is shocked to hear that they're dying of radiation poisoning, realizing it's his power that caused it. Later, Nuke is absent from a squadron meeting where the team discuss the progress in getting the country back on its feet. They're interrupted by a projection of the Scarlet Centurion, who taunts them that with their world on the brink of collapse, he will invade and take it over. A furious Hyperion promises him that if he tries to invade again, instead of letting him retreat to his own timeline again, that he'll kill him with his bare hands. Amused but clearly shaken, Scarlet Centurion decides conquering a ruined world isn't worth the trouble. Afterwards, most of the squadron play poker, but Tom is sidelined again. Later in his lab, Tom is visited by Nuke, who asks him if he'll test his power levels to see if they're increasing. Tom does and finds that they've increased by nearly half in the last year. Nuke tearfully confides in Tom that he's caused his parents cancer and begs Tom to find a cure for the disease. Not knowing what to do, Tom says that he'll do what he can and begins frantically researching all the cancer data he can find and asks to be relieved of field assignments, depriving himself of sleep so that he can work all hours. Lady Lark, Blue Eagle, and Nuke supervise food deliveries when the deliveries are waylaid by angry mobs. Nuke overzealously scares them off with a cloud of fallout and has to be subdued by Lady Lark. Nuke goes to see Tom, who's made a containment suit, but Nuke says that that isn't what he wanted. He wants his parents cured. Tom works all hours of the day to find a cure, but realizes he doesn't have enough time. Tom decides that time is the answer and uses the trans-temporal soma projector to travel to the Scarlet Centurion's time to find a cure for cancer there. Meeting with the Centurion, he tells him he'll give anything, even his life, for the cure. Centurion says he'll give Tom the cure if Tom sprinkles Argonite in Hyperion's food to weaken him enough for Centurion to be able to kill him. Tom says he can't do it and returns to his own time. Nuke goes to see Tom, who admits he can't cure cancer. Nuke is incensed and tells Tom that when his parents die, it'll be Tom's fault and he'll kill him for it. Nuke flies angrily away, so he doesn't hear Tom saying that while doing his research, he discovered he's dying of cancer too. Now, you mentioned, Sean, the fact that they were doing things here that they had never done before in mainstream comics. Let's limit it to that, I guess. And I definitely agree with that totally. I see, just the level of anger and reaction by Nuke. The fact that Tom is diagnosed with cancer probably is not groundbreaking, because we've had people in these stories who've been diagnosed with deadly diseases that get cured. That's not uncommon. But I do think it's uncommon for that deadly disease to be cancer. I don't think we've really seen that at this point. So there is, there's a level of reality to what's going on that we don't really see all that often. And I think that's where this becomes groundbreaking. Now, we were talking about how these are existing characters, so to some extent they had a history and all of that, and that makes it a little harder to play with things quite as much because you have established personalities and things that you're working with. But there is also the element, and we talked about whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow. When you're writing what could potentially be the last story, it gives you a lot of freedom to do things that you can't do in an ongoing book. So it's kind of balancing those two things, but I am seeing all sorts of just, again, to me, what I consider to be groundbreaking things and realistic, not necessarily likable personality traits from some of the people. And I think that's a big key to this series. It's not, you know, you want your heroes to be likable. And I think they achieve that by having them have a positive goal, even if they're misguided in how they're trying to reach it. But you also see the fallibility, which is key to making these stories interesting. Because if they're just, you know, wonderful people and, you know, la, 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 let's just go along and all be happy. I think, you know, you lose a lot of the drama by them being fallible and by them having personality quirks that make them, you know, that they're trying to overcome things in, you know, their own weaknesses. I think that's huge. And I think it's probably one of the biggest strengths of the story.
One of the things I do love about this is the fact that you've got these characters where they ended last issue with this, we're taking off our masks, we're going to be transparent with you, and then did everything but be transparent. They've got a lot of secrets behind the scenes in the back and what's going on, a lot of things they're covering up for. And I think some of that's true. I mean, it's very grounded in the sense that you've got these characters, to your point, Paul, they're flawed. I don't know if they went out of their way to make them lovable or likable. And I think you're right on everything you're saying there. I think it was relatable because I think you, you can put what they're going through and their reactions to it into some context of how would I react if I was in that situation? Which sometimes with heroes, they're up high and we're especially the DC heroes, which I love. You know, Superman's da-da-da, you know, he's always doing, you know, these great, amazing, good things, and he's got this moral code that you should be, we're striving for, right? We want to be Superman. In the case of the Squadron, in various ways, you can probably plug yourself into certain elements of what they're going through and say, oh, and I'm not proud of the fact that I might react that way. And there's something cool about that. You mentioned Tom Thumb and the cancer and Nuke and what was going on with that storyline. I think what they did with that is they recognized we're skirting this line with Tom Thumb. We want to keep him sympathetic because the Squadron's not great to him. He's this big brain that they've got on the team, but because of the fact that he isn't your puncher, he doesn't have that kind of power set, he drifts into the background and is very self-conscious about it. I love that aspect of the character. Because I think we've, at various points in time in your life, right, we've all felt marginalized. And I felt like that was something that Tom Thumb brought to the table. Nuke's story is incredibly intriguing because we're taking these masks off. Now we've got this guy he's not telling his parents because of the fact that he thinks his powers caused this problem with it. And we wrapped him back up again in this new nuclear outfit that he's got, that, you know, the radiation outfit that Tom Thumb's made for him. He's now not with the mask off, I'm Nuke, you know, and this is who I really am in real life. He's actually being packaged again because of the secret that's being kept that is separating him from the team. I think Tom Thumb having cancer is yet another layer to make you say he makes some choices, which we're going to talk about. He makes some choices in this, and I think it's a way to keep him sympathetic too, because of the fact that he's also going through that. He understands the pain that Nuke's feeling, even though Nuke's got a whole bunch of other problems. Nuke is a fun character to follow in this, because you've got the Squadron trying to do their goals, but they've got this internal turmoil that's going on that they're trying to keep that media spin to cover up, because of their utopia they're trying to achieve. And I feel that's something where, if you talk about cutting edge, this is stuff that, this is how our media reacts today, right? No matter where you fall, our media does this. So I feel like they were touching on topics that you can read this today. If you're listening to this and you haven't read this, do yourself a favor and read it. It is a story that is touching on some topics that I think you can connect with with the current way that we interact with our media. And I think that's something that I still think is cutting edge today. It's interesting reading this now. There's so much of it that I thought I remembered. And then when you read it, you said it earlier, Paul, there's fine details in this that I completely forgot. And it's fun to read it because it's dense. It's a very dense read. I think we're used to comics having a certain flavor now, and the amount of dialogue and the amount of storytelling they're doing They gave everybody screen time, which is hard to do when you've got a cast this size.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as far as the size of the cast, I'm pretty confident that I'm pretty sure that Grunewald went out of his way. I think he created some of these characters for the sake of this story. Or was that, I know they had guested in the Avengers at one point where they had an expanded roster from the original four-man team. I don't know if they all existed. Like, I don't remember Nuke before this, although he may have been in that Defenders story. I'm not sure. But clearly, no question about it, that Grunewald wanted the expanded roster and wanted to be able to show the disparity of the personalities and the goals. And I think, you know, I am loath to discuss politics on the show, and for obvious reasons. But I think it shows you that no matter which side of the aisle you're on, you could have the best intentions of the world, but be wrong-minded just the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would probably, when you look at this as kind of a lesson for people out there today, I think you can say both sides of the aisle can look at that and say, hey, I know what my goal is, but how do I reach it? What's the right way to reach it? And is that goal reachable? Which is a huge, huge question. You know, it's one thing to have great intentions, but it's another thing to say, well, can I do what my intentions say? And that's, you know, that's as far into politics as I'm going to go in this episode. But I do think it's thought-provoking, and put it that way. And it's thought-provoking in 1986, and it's thought-provoking in 2025. So, you know, I just think that's a huge part of this. Gene, we've kind of stamped you down and not let you speak. Why don't you go ahead?
Well, I like how Grunewald juggles a lot of different storylines in this. I mean, you've got the overall Utopia project with the, oh, here's the food distribution. But as part of that, and this is why the councilman took the mayor hostage, is the people of the world still view the squadron as conquerors because they haven't been told about the mind control. If they were told, they probably wouldn't believe it. So it's like, oh, yes, I just threw you all in internment camps 2 months ago, but please trust me now. So they're fighting to overcome that. The whole Nuke thing with the, you know, knowing he's the cause of his parents' eventual death is what drives him batty, really. And then you have Tom, who's trying his best to help out a teammate, but has principles that he will not cross. He could easily cure cancer for everyone, but he won't kill to do it.
Yeah.
Whether directly or indirectly. And that's one of the things about tackling something like this. And it's just like Roy Thomas with All-Star Squadron. And it's like, oh, we have these superpower beings in World War II who could easily just, it's done. I need to create something that will prevent that, that will not solve this real world problem with a comic book solution. And Grunewald does an amazing job with the cancer thing here. Because, you know, if he, oh, yes, I cured cancer, people are going to be like, really? That, no, you don't cure cancer. You can cure disease X55 from planet Zeta, but you don't cure an actual disease because it isn't cured. But then you've got the real subtle stuff in the artwork. Like, where we see, you know, Tom's getting overlooked, and some of it's overt, like, you know, oh, he says, oh, I don't. but before that, on that same page, the mayor, Dr. Spectrum, and Golden Archer are up on this flatbed, and Tom is climbing up, and his arm is up, like, hey, Archer, give me a hand up, and Archer's ignoring him. So it's even, you know, with the overt stuff, you have a lot of subtlety involved. I just think this hits on on every level. It's really, really well done.
There's definitely a hierarchy in this team. You know what I mean? Right away, there's a certain level of respect for certain characters. Paul, you mentioned the expanded cast of this one. I don't remember if everybody was, because I did not get a chance to read every story until years later, led up to this. I don't remember if every cast member was in there, but I think you're right. There's characters that were created in this, like Nuke is a great example. I don't remember seeing Nuke anywhere before this. And I think the expanded roster led to this internal dynamic of your top tier characters that are your traditional Justice Leaguers, right? It's your Superman, Batman, mm-hmm. Wonder Woman kind of dynamic. Then you got your just directly below them with Dr. Spectrum. And you can see that these guys are not at the same level as the top tier of the team. They are the next level down. Your Green Arrow, your Green Lantern, your Flash, they are important and they have a long history. Then you've got your bottom tier where they're members, they're added on members, but they are in many ways very much deferring to the team. Nuke's one of them. Tom Thumb's one of them. They're mentioned on the team, and you know, when they're missing, or they're doing something else, they're acknowledged, but they clearly are not considered to be the main roster of the group by the team. And I love that internal, because I feel it's a very realistic internal dynamic when you've got mm-hmm. a group of size. And I'm glad that they play with this. That's something that I could not have appreciated, ninth grade me. And it's interesting reading this now, like having just a more of an adult lens at this particular story arc and seeing some of the things that they were playing around with. It's a different sort of read.
You know, we had a recent conversation where we were talking about the need for conflict in stories, that otherwise it's boring. And in watching a lot of television dramas as they go on, I've noted that a lot of the tension is created by people just not sharing information that they should share. If mm-hmm. people would just speak to their significant other, speak to their teammates, speak to whoever, and tell them what's going on, all the drama would be eliminated in a lot of the cases. One of the things I'm seeing here is Tom visiting the Scarlet Centurion, being told, well, if you'll poison Hyperion so that I can kill him, then I'll give you the cure to cancer. And then Tom just, you know, he does the more noble thing by saying, no, I can't do that. Mm-hmm. But then he just keeps it to himself. I know he promised Nuke he wasn't going to share about his parents, but wouldn't it make sense? And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm spitballing here. But wouldn't it make sense to go to Hyperion and say, the project I've been working on is I'm trying to cure cancer, which would fall directly in line with our efforts to create a perfect society.
Mm-hmm.
I've been frustrated. And I went to the Scarlet Centurion's time to see if they have the cure and if I can get it. And this is what occurred. Obviously, I'm not going to poison you. But is there a way maybe that we can manipulate this to our benefit and get this cure? Or, you know, I don't see this as a reality, but maybe Hyperion would say, you know what? I'm willing to be sacrificed to cure cancer. So go ahead and go along with his plan. I don't know what, you know, where it would go, how it would go, but it's just like, again, if there was a sharing of information, then at least it would be a more well-reasoned plan. Maybe there's a way we could trap the Scarlet Centurion somehow. We'll make him think we're going along with it, and then we'll move along. I know we're trying to be, you know, very, very open about everything we're doing, and deception isn't our way, but maybe in this case it's worth our while. I don't know, but it just feels like the whole keeping it a secret is the problem.
I think Hyperion would go and take it. this character, I think if it was the case, I mean, he'd be like, no, we're going to go grab this. I think Tom's worries, though, again, shows the cracks of this team. You guys can correct me if you think I'm wrong on this one. I think Tom, in reality, think about how he's treated by the Green Lantern, Green Arrow amalgams in this world. I mean, we see Hal and Ollie, you know, at this. And I think this would be kind of like what it'd be like to be on a team with Hal and Ollie. They're in the spotlight, and they're those kind of characters. They've got that flavor about them. And Tom's very dismissed. I think Tom thinks, if I reveal this, I'm off the team. Nuke's going to be mad at me because I revealed his secret. I don't know that Hyperion's going to have my back. And I think some of these concerns, when you take a look at the interpersonal dynamics of this team, are valid. I don't know that this is a team where you have that open doorway to be truthful. I think he's trying to be ethical on a team where ethics are not this team's strongest suit. They're doing good things, and I think their intentions are good, but they're so different, each one of them, that they don't have, as a squad, as the Squadron Supreme, as a group, they really do not have a standard way of operating where, like, everybody believes the same philosophy and we're all aiming towards the same goal. They're all good people that have banded together because they're good people. But, oh my gosh, the cracks show when you sit there and see how different they are and their interactions. And I actually like that aspect about this a great deal, because there's a reason why Tom wouldn't say anything. And I'm with you. You could correct this real quickly for Nuke by revealing it to the team. Because I think Hyperion, he go get it. because he's in a place right now where his philosophy shifted during this early part of this storyline to, if the world's not the way we want it to be, we're going to make it that way. Mm-hmm. And he is all in that place. We just said we are going to get rid of disease. We are going to do everything we can to make people healthier, make people live longer, perhaps cheat death. So he would be all in on it, because that would be one of the exclamation points that he promised. He said, within a year, we're going to do these things. So I think he would have gone after him. And I think, Paul, you're bringing up an excellent point of, what if Hyperion knew? I actually would love to see, let's do a what if. What if Hyperion found out about the cure? Because I think that would have been an issue. I think we would have seen I think we'd see the Kang battle we were talking about.
Mm-hmm. I think that Tom has another reason for not sharing any of this, because I think he's ashamed. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at everything that he's done to this point, they go to Tom, Tom solves the problem. Whether he's ignored socially or not, it's when they come to him, he solves it. And this, not only was he not able to find a cure for cancer, he stooped low enough to go to one of their enemies and beg. So he's probably so ashamed that he doesn't want to tell anyone, you know, even Nuke, who, you know, if he said, hey, I tried everything, I even went this far, Nuke may not have heard him with the grief he's going through, but at least it would have been more than, no, I can't do it. You know? So I think it's just the shame keeping him from saying, I failed, to the, you know, the larger team.
Yeah. But I think that's where dramatically this story is showing us the fact that the perfection they strive for just is not attainable.
Right.
But even in this small group, they can't keep total, you know, honesty among themselves, that egos get involved, that tempers get involved, that embarrassment gets involved. There's so much stuff. And it's, I think it's well played the way Tom, you know, is marginalized. So you see why, you know, I mean, it's not exactly subtle, don't get me wrong, but you see why it becomes so important to him to try and keep up with the big boys in his own way, that he doesn't want to ask for help. And that is a personality trait you can respect, but it's also a personality flaw. So you can't create a perfect society. You just can't. There's no possibility of it. I mean, that is just the reality. Eden is unattainable. But you could try and get as close to it as possible, but you know, you're never gonna get there. And I was close to giving an example in real life, and I'm going to not do that because I'd rather keep from focusing on politics in the show. But again, I think you can look to lessons in the real world and see where goals are wonderful and they're respectable, but are unattainable.
I do think where, and I agree with you, let's kind of avoid skirting the political line. I will say this. I feel this story is very accessible right now, no matter where you sit. Mm-hmm. If you're, you know, left, right, whatever, doesn't matter any of that. I think this story today, there's so much, comics are at their best when, you know, art imitates life and you can learn something from it. The nice part about this story is not reflective of any of our real world politics right now. There are echoes in here. There are themes in here that you can latch on to and think about. And I think we're in an era right now where it's hard to talk about politics, which is exactly what you're alluding to, Paul. And I think this is a great story for right now to kind of read and go, let's objectively look at both sides of the fence on this one, because I think this one touches everything. And it's a great story, I think, today to read and think. I mean, because I think there's a lot that it makes you think in your mind because of the fact that it's completely disconnected from today's politics on any level. And when I say today's politics, I don't mean even just right today. I'm talking about maybe the last decade. If you take a look at that, I think there's something here for everybody, no matter where you fall, to kind of just think through, you know, how you look at today's world. And I think it's always fun when you can look back at a story back from the 80s that is touching on themes that I think they're relevant today. I think you're right to skirt the line, though.
Yeah, I think that is part of the, I'm going to use the word brilliance of this story, in that it is relatable no matter what era you're in.
Yeah.
I can point to things today, and I can point to things from 10 years ago and 20 years ago, and I can point to things from World War II. You know, you can go to any era and you could say the concepts that they're presenting here are applicable. If, you know, and it goes to the, you know, if you want to break it down to its more simple, you start with the theory of power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Even if your intentions are good. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's why, again, I'm just going to say, I'm not going to relate it to today's politics. I'm going to relate it to our government system. That's why we have checks and balances.
Right.
I like that a lot. You know, just as far, because you're right, that's accessible to anybody. We do it that way. Gene, one of the things that was interesting on the first episode for me, this was your first read through for this, right?
Like, yes, it is.
This is fresh today for you. So the one piece I've got from this is just an intense amount of nostalgia. Now, when I say that, I read it over and over again when it first came out. And this is during the era of my life where at a certain point in time, in order to keep reading more comics, I was selling comics to get comics.
Aha.
So this series, I bought it in trade. I reread it in trade at some point in time, but it's sat for a long, long time. I want to say it sat until for decades. So reading this now is very fresh for me, but I've got a lot of nostalgia, which is very clear in my comments on this piece. In your case, you don't have that. You didn't read it back then. Does this feel dated at all to you? I mean, as far, because I'm not feeling that, but again, I've got a different nostalgia flavor for this piece. I'm intrigued by that because I feel like there's so much of this is cutting edge, but what does that feel like for you? Because you can speak more objectively to it. Because you read it back in the day too.
Yeah, this actually, it feels really timeless for me. I mean, I've got kind of a nostalgia thing because, you know, I was reading comics at this time. I didn't read this, you know, this series, but, it, you know, you get the 80s Marvel aesthetic to it. But it, because we're dealing with a world that has been pretty much destroyed and they're rebuilding it, there's not the pop culture references or the technology kind of thing that'll take you out of it. Like, oh, they can go to and use a rotary phone, for example. It's just, it's generic enough that it's just the story comes through, and it's, you know, like Paul said, it's applicable to today as much as it was 40 years ago. So it's, it definitely holds up. You know, I'm not thrown out of the story by anything. It's, and like you said, that's not nostalgia talking. That's, it just comes across for any first time reader of this, I would say they would have no issues with it at all. You know, it's not dated whatsoever. If anything, with some of the stuff, it's become more relevant.
Absolutely. Now, I'm just going to change course a little bit to talk about the artwork. And it's an interesting thing. The cover is by Bob Hall with Bob Layton inking it. Bob Layton did not ink the interiors. I think Bob Layton is one of the absolute best inkers ever. Mm-hmm. I think he's just tremendous. I think he's, again, just an all-time great. And I started thinking to myself when I was reading it, would be interesting if Bob Layton had inked the interiors. Mm. And it's one of the rare cases where I'm going to say, I think we're better not using one of the all-time greats to do it, because while I love Bob Layton's style, the artwork in this has a dystopian feel to it.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know that Bob Layton's work, because it's so crisp and clean, and again, it falls right in line with what I love in comics, but I don't know if that crisp, clean style lends itself to a dystopian feel as well as what we get here. So I'm going to say that they made the right choice. And in that respect, I feel like the cover, although very well rendered, does not really give me quite the feel that I want as far as reflecting what we're going to get in the story. Because the cover feels very much traditional superhero-y. Whereas the story, again, it's putting our heroes into situations where we haven't seen before, and we are going with that dystopian feel. So I don't know that it works as well. It brings to mind for me a lot of the early 60s Superman covers where he'd be on another planet. You know, we recently covered one on here where, you know, he was on another planet and his powers were negated by a red sun, and then like a caveman type guy had taken his uniform and was wearing it, and they had to battle. And I think about the cover of that where it shows Superman in a caveman's clothes and a caveman in Superman's outfit, and they're fighting each other. But the dark feel of that cover, and I refer to that one only because it's one we covered recently, so people might actually have a recollection of it. But that had almost a dystopian feel to it on the cover, despite the fact that it was, you know, 25 years before this. This cover does not give me the dystopian feel. This cover gives me a traditional superhero feel. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, although it is, again, very well rendered, and it does reflect something we get in the story, but I think it fails on that level. Any thoughts?
It's funny, thinking back to the covers. I was, again, listening to you guys from the last episode. I'm trying to remember. I always felt there were good covers. But this isn't one of those books where I feel like the covers drew me into the book. It sounds like I'm being very insulting of the covers. They're good covers. Nothing wrong with them, you know, anything like that. But it's not one of those where I'm like, I've got to have this as a poster. You know, there's covers where I'm like, I want this in some capacity. I mean, I wouldn't have I wouldn't have like paintings or wallpapers in my house if I got every cover that I felt that way about. But I'm trying to think of one, and maybe I will as I continue to read along with this storyline. But I don't have that cover where I'm going, I need to have this Squadron Supreme cover, which is, I think, an interesting sort of piece off of this. I think they're good covers. I think they get you into the book, but I feel at the end of the day, the story surpasses the cover, which sometimes the cover is this like amazing draw that like pulls you in. And sometimes the story on the inside doesn't quite match the cover that you're given, because we'll have a cover artist that has really knocked it out of the park and delivered this amazing piece. This is an interesting where I feel the story in between is, and I think the artwork inside, I agree with you, Paul. I think there's a tone to the artwork on the interiors that is very different. I wasn't thinking about that until you mentioned it. And I was like, wow, I know the covers haven't really stood out for me with this, other than being good. I mean, they're, you know, I don't hate them, but I don't have that cover. I don't know. I don't know if Gene, if you, what do you feel about it? Where are you at?
I mean, you can't really go wrong with Bob Layton, but I see the point that yes, it's, you know, it is definitely more of a, this is generic superhero, but I'm wondering because of the way the story is, right? I'm wondering if that wasn't a marketing choice, like, hey,
quite possibly.
This is a superhero story, you know, please try it, as and then you get inside and you're gripped by what's actually going on, but it doesn't stand out as something that a typical comic book buyer would avoid, you know.
If you're a Marvel reader in the 80s and you see this on the shelf, you're going to feel like, "Oh, I should be pulling this."
Right, exactly.
Something like that. I think you're nailing something there. I wasn't even thinking about it from a marketing standpoint, but this and admittedly, thinking back to the 80s, this looks like it belongs in the Marvel line. Like, if I'm a Marvel reader, why am I not reading this? Why am I not at least checking this out? I think there's a very valid point to that.
It would be interesting to know the behind the scenes publication history a little bit, if there were any rejected covers. Or if there was a, you know, mandate from editorial, you know, this is the way you want to do this series, that's fine, but this is the way you got to go with it. I mean, the bottom line is they were producing these books to make money.
Yeah.
So, Gene, you present a very valid point that, you know, that could be, let's let the story stand on the strength of the story, but let's pull people in so that they read that story and see how good it is. And the further you get into a series like this, if you know, it's, I'm not going to look at the cover again. Does it say on it that it's a 12 issue maxi series?
Yes. Yeah.
So the further
limited series were Marvel.
Okay. But the further you get into a limited series where somebody hasn't picked up any issues, the less likely they are to want to pick it up off the stands. Mm. Because they already know, you know, hey, this is only going to go for a finite period of time, and I've missed the whole, you know, setting of the ground in it. So that there's definitely a thing there. So you definitely want to pull in as many readers as you can, as early as you can.
The 12-issue series for this part was interesting with these characters. It was an interesting, bold choice, because we're used to, like, everything's built for a trade nowadays, you know, as far as how, like, everything's crafted, you know, like 5 issues, 6 issues, maybe, you know, crafted for a trade purposes. 12-issue series is not as common now. But back then, it also was not. It usually was something reserved for, like, a Secret Wars or, you know, characters that were more, like Vision, Scarlet Witch, things like that, where you would get that. To do this with Squadron Supreme, you're counting on your readers making a commitment to at a time where it's a little bit harder to grab a limited series that's going to be 12 issues than it is today. We're used to the accessibility of, if I want it, I can get it. You couldn't then. I mean, you really had to commit yourself. Paul, you mentioned pull lists. My comic shop didn't offer them yet. They would set aside stuff for you, but they didn't have like a pull list opportunity. They didn't have, like, you know, in the behind the scenes, you would get them. I did. There were times where I'd walked in and they had saved me a copy because I had mentioned it. But it was that versus an actual traditional pull list. I think it's so cool that your shop was more, I think, future thinking, starting to grab the pull list where it's like, you come in, we got your stuff waiting for you. That was smart. I don't know that every comic shop was doing it back then. As retailers probably conversed, they started sharing those ideas and getting them. But I went to Comics and Collectibles at Shoregate, ride my bike up there. It was an event, because you were hoping that your book came out this weekend, that they still had a copy for you when you got there. And this was one of those books that I rode to the comic shop to make sure I grabbed, because the story was doing that. It had a lot of room to breathe, which you didn't get a lot in traditional comics, because you didn't have 12 issue arcs. Stories were very much geared to bring you up to speed every issue, so that way you could jump on. This does some of that, and it does it very well, because it does do recaps along the way. Mm-hmm. But the 12 issue maxi series part of this is something that really stands out as being just something that was unique during that time. I don't remember a lot of them. I don't know if you guys do remember there being a ton of these
12 issues. No, not many at this point.
No.
Yeah. All right, do we want to move to our synopsis of issue 3 now?
Sure. Well, do we want to grade this one first?
Sure. The cover, I feel, is good. It's serviceable. It certainly, you know, would potentially pull people in, and it does give you something you give in the story, but for reasons that we've talked about, it doesn't quite cut it for me. And even on a just on a individual basis of the cover itself, I almost feel like it really didn't get my juices flowing, where I felt like, oh my God, I got to see what happens here. So I'm going to say it's very well rendered, which gives it a B, but that's as high as I can go with it.
Mm-hmm.
The interior art, and I've made no bones about it, I am not a Bob Hall fan. In the past, I've criticized a lot of books that we've covered with him. But as we said when we covered the first issue, I think he's truly bringing his A game here. And I think it gives you the feel of what you want. The choreographed story is really good. You know, it's paced really well. He's dealing with all these characters in a George Perezian fashion. There's a lot going for it. I'm going to give the interior art an A. I really think it sets the tone that I want, and it just really gives me the story. And I'm also going to say the story is excellent. It's thought-provoking. It's also an A. Despite my slightly lower grade for the cover, I'm giving the overall A for this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get what you're saying about the cover, but I'm going to give it a B+. Just because I do think it was a marketing choice, even though it doesn't match. But bonus points for having something that kind of sort of happened in the issue. Yeah, I think Bob Hall is one of those artists where it's a you got to get him on the right project kind of thing. But this is the right project. He's got some excellent facial expressions, Nuke's desperation. Tom Thumb's, you know, just dejection of, you know, how he can't solve this problem. And it's really, really well done. So definitely an A on the art. And I already said the story is, Gruenwald's juggling all kind of different plot lines and getting everything moving forward. So I'm going to give the story an A+. But an A for the book as a whole.
It's funny when I look at the cover, I was a firm B on the cover, until Gene, you made the comment that you did. And when I look at this cover, I can't help but look at it now and just go, well, this is really good Marvel superhero. I do feel like I'm moving it to a B+, but I got to give you credit for that because of the fact that you've given me a different lens into the cover. Mm. So I was not looking at it that way before this conversation. So I've got to say the grading up of it is definitely due to, I think you're right, they were trying to market this. And I feel like it works from that standpoint. I'm a big fan of Bob Hall's Shadow Man. So if you're not, or you are, that gives you kind of a baseline as far as where I'm at with his artwork. I think where Bob Hall thrives, and it's some of, I think, what Paul's alluding to, or and Gene, you just said it just now about the right project. I feel like when Bob Hall has the opportunity to create atmosphere and mood and really create a world, you mentioned dystopian future, you know, this dystopian feel in this type of thing before, Paul. And I think that's where this is working for me. The interiors really have started to build a world here that I find that even from issue one to issue two, I've settled into this world now and I'm embracing it. And I think Bob Hall thrives in this kind of space. This is his kind of thing. It is a lot of what I like about Shadow Man. This is not Shadow Man. If you've anybody who's read Shadow Man, you're not going to get, it's not the same atmosphere with his New Orleans theme, what he was doing in that book. But I feel like it's, there is a link here to this is where Bob Hall works in just creating this kind of atmosphere and mood. And I agree with you. This space that he's created, the world that he's building here, I'm enjoying it. It matches very much the dialogue that's being delivered. Mm. That's where this is an A. I feel like tonally, the artwork really understands its goal and the story it's trying to deliver. This is great storytelling. And so I do feel this is an A. I mean, I'm just really enjoying. There's a lot going on and nothing is at conflict between the writer and the artists and the art team on this one. And that's always great as a reader when you just are, you can be engrossed in something and not go, oh, that was jarring. we've all experienced that before. And if anything, I think we feel the most jarring part of this sometimes is the cover because tonally it's a little bit different.
Right. Okay. So Squadron Supreme issue number 3. This was cover dated November 1985, actually came out June 23rd, 1985, with the exact same creative team. On the cover, we have Dr. Spectrum facing off against Nuke high above what looks like an industrial center. Showdown starts with a splash page of Power Princess using her shield to deflect the hail bullets. We then see that this is a TV spot she is filming and narrating, where she displays how she can defeat dozens of soldiers without killing them, but not everyone can. Hence the need for everyone to give up their firearms. As the shoot wraps up, Dr. Spectrum plays a prank and Power Princess's top comes down, so she flashes the studio. After threatening to remove his pants in retaliation, she sells for his cape. Power Princess then discusses how this is just the first step with the president and how he'll hear about the next stage very soon. She then has a brief off-camera visit with her lover before heading back to the mountain base. She walks in just after Whizzer reprimands Dr. Spectrum for his prank and for getting the cameraman to send him an uncensored copy of the video. At the meeting, Power Princess gives an update on the taping, but doesn't mention the prank. Hyperion reports that all gun and ammunition manufacturers are shut down. Golden Archer and Lady Lark relate that they had a successful personal appearance in another city. The meeting wraps up with Hyperion saying that Nuke has been missing the last. Meeting wraps up with Hyperion saying that Nuke has missed the last 28 meetings, and it's time to go look for him. Tom Thumb thinks back to the events of last issue, but refuses to betray Nuke's secret about his parents. Whizzer volunteers to look for Nuke, but Power Princess suggests that Dr. Spectrum do it, since the two of them are close. Spectrum reluctantly agrees, even though Power Princess says they are not even. Tom Thumb gives Spectrum a vague hint about searching hospitals, and he flies off. Spectrum arrives in Motor City, wonder what that could be, looking for Nuke in the suburbs, and comes across a glowing crater, which he believes was made by the young hero. Spectrum then flies into town and finds a tavern that Nuke took him to once. Meanwhile, back at Squadron Headquarters, Whizzer is reading in bed, wondering if he should have gone with Spectrum. Unfortunately, his powers require a large amount of rest to recover, so he couldn't leave immediately. He then regrets the lack of space requiring a co-ed dorm, especially since he's married and Arcana apparently sleeps in the nude. There's an alert, though, and he, Arcana, and Amphibian are called to Tom Thumb. There's a riot and raid on a gun factory that needs to be dealt with. Back in Motor City, Dr. Spectrum is the center of attention as he walks into a hospital that the tavern patrons pointed him to after some rough persuasion. After asking the receptionist about Nuke's parents, he's told that they both passed away. Going against his better judgment, Spectrum tries to find Nuke at his parents' house. Whizzer, Arcana, and Amphibian are flying to deal with the riot. Amphibian stays in the vehicle while Whizzer and Arcana jump out. Arcana uses the wind to glide them down, and Wizard swats the bullets fired at them out of the way. They land, and Wizard quickly disarms everyone he can, with Arcana getting the rest. Arcana then questions one of the rioters, who tells her that they fear total gun confiscation, which is why they're stocking up now. The squadron has their powers, but normal people need weapons to protect themselves, especially if the government goes crazy again. Holy Second Amendment, Nighthawk. Arcana doesn't pay this argument any mind, assuring him that the squadron has everyone's best interests at heart. At the same time, Dr. Spectrum, has made it to Nuke's house, but Nuke is not there, man. Spectrum speaks to Nuke's little brother, Scott, who says that he hasn't seen him since the funeral. After agreeing to take Scott flying with him, with his guardian's permission, the two search for Nuke and end up at a cemetery. They find Nuke at his parents' graves, and Nuke is incensed that Spectrum would bring his brother and tell Nuke's secret. Nuke rebuffs Spectrum's show of concern, telling Spectrum that none of the squadron care about his problems, especially since Tom Thumb couldn't cure his parents' cancer. That Tom Thumb could cure his parents' cancer, but refused to. He's a little twisted in the head. Spectrum agrees to leave, but first asks how the glowing crater got there. Nuke demonstrates by blowing up part of the cemetery, scaring his brother, and making Spectrum take a stand. Nuke, however, flies off to kill Tom Thumb. Spectrum flies Scott back to his guardians, then tracks Nuke's radiation trail. Once Spectrum catches up, he and Nuke have a brief tussle, which ends when Nuke is trapped in a bubble, is knocked out through the sheer power use, and using up all of the oxygen. Spectrum opens up the bubble and catches Nuke's limp form, but it's too late. Since all the oxygen was used up, Nuke died from asphyxiation. Spectrum brings Nuke's body back to headquarters and completely breaks down over what he's done, only to be comforted by Power Princess. 2 days later, Dr. Spectrum visits Scott, telling him how his brother died and that they need to remember all of the good things Nuke did as a hero, and hopefully someday Scott can forgive him. And you thought last issue was heavy.
Yeah, this was shocking to me. But it's showing us, we're seeing a lot of what we've alluded to so far, and we're seeing it now kind of come into fruition of a lot of good intentions gone bad. That you can't create Eden. On a minor level, you have Wizard, who's obviously got a very strong moral compass and trying to assess the way things are, but just the same, he's not coming clean to his wife about the situation because mm-hmm. he's afraid she won't approve. So, you know, you're seeing a conflict there on a minor level, but then on a much, much more significant level, you're seeing, Dr. Prism with his, Power Prism, whatever, that you know, he's a little bit of a wise ass, and that kind of gets you against him until you see him trying to do the right thing, and then you see, you know, it's not all as simple as you want it to be. You know, we all want things to be very simple, and comic books in the past have presented things as being very simple in a lot of the cases. And I think that was the growing up of the, really from this, you know, from the Golden Age to the Silver Age to the Bronze Age to the Modern Age, where it's happened little by little, where you've seen more consequences to good intentions than what you had seen in the past. You know, and originally it was all, you know, well and good. You just stood there, put your hands on your hips and looked heroic, and you were, you know, and now it's, you know, it's the complexities of life come in and human nature come in. And you're also seeing it even with the, you know, the crowd dealing with the gun control saying, you know, yeah, even if you guys have the right intentions, we can't necessarily trust each other. Mm-hmm. And what if, you know, what if, even if we trust you guys, what if you decide, well, we're going to turn on you anyway, because you've already done it once. Mm-hmm. And then we get the fact that the squadron isn't even being totally transparent in what they're giving, because the people don't even know. And we've seen that in the last two issues with, you know, with the crowd control situations that have come up. So again, Grunewald is dealing with some complex issues, and I think he's handling them masterfully. The fact that Nuke died was absolutely shocking to me. That I didn't recall that from when I had read this in the past. So I didn't see it coming, although I should have. And it was very, very powerful.
It also validates Tom Thumb's choices.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that, you know, I mean, he was stuck with this big moral decision, but I'm going to be honest with you. He had told Nuke that he could have cured cancer, and what came clean with, you know, his reasons why he didn't, Nuke would have killed him. I mean, it's Nuke was gone at this point in time. And I think it's an example of this team buying into their own PR. Like, there is their public-facing persona. And as a team, they're interacting with each other based on their public-facing persona. They are not getting to really know each other. So there are things that are escaping them. They think of them as annoyances. Like, even what happened early on with the photo shoot and things like that. These are things that are, you know, irritants. But we're not really saying, like, hey, this is Spectrum's personality. Maybe we should talk about that and have a conversation around, hey, you know, you're part of the team here. Let's talk about who you are and, like, who do you want to be and why should you be here? They're not. Those type of things are so great in this because they're ignoring those things or keeping them on the down low. It's actually where the cracks are growing. Mm-hmm. It's also making them not look at Hyperion and really taking a look at what are we doing here? I think it's they've got this great idea of making this utopia, but they're not, like, questioning their methods and what they're doing and, you know, they're what they're trying to achieve. I love that about this. It's so smart in the areas where seemingly little things become giant in what's happening here. Paul, I'm with you. I forgot that Nuke died there. But then when I read it, I'm like sitting here, oh yeah. And it's one of the reasons why I think I have such fond memories of this story. They killed somebody who's been a main character. You know, when you think about how much of page time has been devoted to Nuke and his family in this, he is a main player in this. And storytelling, they killed him off this early in the story after giving him so much page time. And it has a major impact on what's going on here. And I think it's such a bold move.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's one of these things where you don't consider certain real world implications of, like, Green Lantern's power, for example, because he's always trapping people in bubbles and whatnot. Well, okay. You're doing that to block their powers. Like Nuke's radiation, obviously that's also going to block air. So, you know, it's one of these things that it's something that Dr. Spectrum has probably done hundreds of times against enemies, never thought about the consequences of it, especially when that enemy won't stop. So, you know, it's one of these things where it's an unfortunate consequence, but it's probably also justifiable. You know,
I think there's also the factor that he hadn't considered with Nuke releasing the energy within the bubble, that he was burning off the oxygen and
right,
causing his own demise within the bubble. But all he needed to do was kind of give a release for it and let oxygen in. And you know, but then what would have happened then? What would Nuke have done with that opening?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was almost presented as a no, you know, the Kobayashi Maru. It's an unwinnable situation.
And it wasn't his intention. That's absolutely the part I think that works for it. Like, I don't feel like he did anything wrong. I felt like he was trying to contain a situation and unfortunately it went awry. And I think that's the brilliant writing on this piece is I'm not, like, chastising Dr. Spectrum at the end of this piece. I'm very sad about what happened. I feel like this is a tragedy that happened. But sometimes you can put that together and you're like, well, he could have done this. He should have done that. With that power set, he was containing it. And there's a lot of reasons to contain that level of power in order for that to happen. I don't know. I don't know what I would do differently in that scenario. And that's the tragedy of it. You sit there and go, yeah, that's what his power does. And of course he should contain that. And it unfortunately went the direction that it did. And that's the part I think that works so well with it. It's you want to, and Paul, I think you said Kobayashi Maru. And I think that's the greatest comparison for this one. I don't know what the win is for this one. And I like when stories present you with something where you think it through and like, oh, that stinks. I don't know what you'd do differently.
Yeah. Well, the other aspect of this that I found interesting is Grunwald carefully showed us that Spectrum's an idiot. He's you know, he's a prankster. He doesn't think about other people's feelings. But he's not, being an idiot doesn't make him evil.
Yeah, he's not vicious about it.
He's vicious a little bit in his joke telling, the whole, but it's a different level. It's not vicious,
right, yeah.
You're wishing, you know, it's not malicious.
Right. He's not trying to, okay, so he'll go so far as to publicly humiliate someone, which she herself said, I don't understand your issue with nudity in this culture. But he's not like, you know, dumping boiling hot oil on her or something like that as a prank.
Yeah, exactly. But having shown us that he has, let's say, a different moral compass than Whizzer, you almost expect that when Nuke passes away unintentionally, that there's a chance that Spectrum might try and cover it up and hide it. So we do see that there's a level he won't reach. He won't sink to a certain point, and he's going to come right out, come clean, let everybody know exactly what happened, because he wasn't wrong necessarily. There was no right. He made the best choice under the circumstances he had. I think that's probably the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Tell me if you agree with this. I feel like with him, his problem is he's immature. Mm-hmm. He loves the pomp and circumstance, not just being a hero. If you take a look at what he does in his real life, I mean, it parallels Hal Jordan, right?
Yeah,
you know, right. In those pieces. He does not want to get grounded in a relationship. He's got a woman in every port, you know, that type of philosophy with him. I mean, you see that kind of he's a well-established character in this miniseries as far as who he is and what his operation is. I don't think he's a bad guy, though. He does things for the purpose of being the coolest guy in the room. He wants the attention. He wants the laughs. He wants to be the life of the party. I do think he likes people and wants the heroic pat on the back. And you see that early on. That's where Tom Thumb gets dismissed by Golden Archer and him when they're having that sequence. Tom Thumb's very dismissed in the background because they want the bows and they're the hard traveling heroes. And hey, buddy, look at, we did it again. And look at that. We're getting the bows and that type of thing. And they like that. And that's the aspect of being superheroes. That is their thing. He, though, the responsibility and the actual responsibility of anything that grounds you in life, he tries to stay away from. And any level, even attachments, everyone's flying off for their attachments. He doesn't know who to go to. Like, he literally contacts somebody just so he is, versus the fact of contacting somebody because there's an emotional responsibility to that piece. So when this all happens, I think he says something because he's not a bad guy. He's actually, there is a good person underneath all of that. And I would actually probably make an argument that if you were to talk to Golden Archer about him and say, you know, what do you think of him? He's probably the best person to talk to about who this character is. You know, as far as that's my buddy and that type of thing. Here's why I like him. He's really a good dude underneath all that. We've had some late night conversations that have shown me he's a good guy. You got to cut through a lot to get there, but he's probably a good guy. And that to me is really good writing. When you see on the, when you see him fleshed out this way and you're like, I know who that guy, I've got friends of mine who are this guy.
I mean, they're people I love, but I am an apologist for them at times. And
you almost feel like he's got an understandable mindset of, hey, I risk my life for the general good. Therefore, when I'm not in a situation where I have to risk my life, I should be able to have fun. Like that's not unreasonable.
Right.
You know, but you don't want to have fun at the expense of others. That's where he goes over the line a little bit. But that's the difference between a thoughtful person and a jerk. That's not the difference between a good person and a bad person. And I think that Grunewald is doing well to define these things.
I mean, Spectrum, he's treating being a superhero like a job. He, you know, when he's not on the clock, he's going to do whatever the heck he wants to do. Poker game, pull out the little black book, whatever. In fact, the only reason he goes after Nuke after finding out that his parents were dead was he doesn't want Hyperion making him fill out more paperwork. You know, he says, well, Hyperion's probably going to, you know, make me come back with an official leave request or something for Nuke to fill out. So yeah. he's doing the right thing, but in this case, he's doing it to just avoid further hassle for himself.
Yes.
And but you can tell when he can't get Nuke to come back, it breaks him. I mean, this character is not going to be any similar to what he was before going forward. He is completely broken, and I'm really interested to see where he goes from here, because I know the main story beats because I've heard people talk about it, but I don't remember anything of what happens to Dr. Spectrum in the rest of the series.
I don't have specific memories of Dr. Spectrum either. And that's the beauty of this. And we talked about it last episode that we covered. This is, I remember the big beats in it. And I remember how much I loved this story, but I don't remember all the subtleties. And it's, when it's been 40 years, it's been 40 years, you know,
right.
That's just the way it is. I did find, just on a totally different level, but when I started actively collecting again, and I went through my issues and I finally got the app on my phone where I could keep track of everything I had. And I did find that I had holes in this 12 issue run, and I was able to pick up the ones that I was missing, which, number one wasn't missing, which I assume is probably the most expensive one to get a hold of. But I was missing about four issues, and little by little I found them, and I found them out of like the $1 bins. This is not, despite being as highly regarded as it is, it's not a very expensive series to get a hold of, put it that way. And it was fairly easy to fill the holes in my collection on this and get the complete 12-issue run. But that didn't lead to my rereading it until Gene and I decided we were going to cover this.
Yeah, collector versus reader. I want to have this. There it is.
Well, there's a definite difference there, and that's where, and I know we're going afield here, but I was talking to somebody at one of the recent comic shows that I went to, and he was saying, I was commenting that I've picked up a great deal of the issues on my want list that you're going to find in the $1 and $2 and $5 bins, and a lot of the issues that are left on my list are the ones that are going to be 20 and 50 and 100 and 500 and $25,000 books. So it's harder to obviously fill those holes in the collection. And this guy was saying, well, yeah, I was doing that. And, I had everything in my Thor run except for the first appearance in Journey into Mystery. So I filled that with one of the reprints. And as a reader, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But as a collector, that does not fill or does not satisfy my desire in any way, shape, or form, because I can get that as a reader copy or a reader thing in, you know, in Origins of Marvel Comics or whatever. It's not a matter of wanting it to read it. It's I want to fill out the collection. And I imagine that Journey into Mystery 83, I believe it is one that will never find its way into my collection just because of the costs and all of that. But, you know, that's where you balance how much you want it against how much it costs.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, if you're a reader, you read on Marvel Unlimited, you know? You don't need a reprint in your collection.
There's multiple, multiple sources of you getting a hold of it. There's, again, Origins of Marvel Comics. There's Marvel Masterworks. There's Marvel Unlimited. There's so many ways to read it, and it's been reprinted so many times, and that's just one example of it. You know, I'm down to... My goal on Spider-Man is to get basically from Amazing Fantasy 15 to issue 300. I'm down to needing 17 issues to fill that run. The problem is they are probably the 17 most expensive issues in the series.
So I was going to say they're the first 17, aren't they?
not quite. I have a solid run from issue 42 to 300 and from 21 to 41. Ah. So I'm only missing 42 to have it be from 21 on. And then I have probably five or six in the below issue 21. So, you know, I look for them when I find them at a reasonably affordable price. I jump on them, but that's few and far between. And Amazing Fantasy 15 and Spider-Man number one, I don't know if I'm ever going to find in a price that I can afford.
Right.
But that's, again, that's the collective thing. To talk more about Squadron Supreme, I thought that the artwork in this issue actually took a jump up from the last issue. I think the inking seems to be more on point. We're getting a little bit more shading, a little bit more shadow, a little bit more detail where it's called for and vagueness where it's called for. I think the storytelling is actually reflected somewhat in the penciling and the inking. So I thought, again, I thought this took a step forward from the last issue, which I thought was very good to begin with. So
I'm going to say something else about that too. It's going to be very wishy-washy over what I said just about the last cover. This is a good cover. I really like this cover.
And well, it's Bob Hall and Bob Layton again.
Yes, but yeah, I mean, I'm going to go back and correct something I said, for at least for myself personally. I'm looking at this cover. I'm like, this cover pops. I really like this cover.
I think this cover serves the purposes on both ends. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing the superhero battle, that fits the marketing end of things. I'm just looking. The cover does not say issue number three in a mini series.
No, it doesn't. Oh, it does not have the limited series on top.
Yes, yeah, so, but it's showing the battle. It's I think extremely well drawn. It does not betray the feel of the inside of the book in any way, but it also doesn't necessarily limit the audience from wanting to see it. I think if anything, it entices the audience, and it is not, you know, as I think you said, Sean, earlier, if I took every issue that had a cover that I thought was poster worthy and had a poster of it, I would run out of wall space in like a minute. Yeah. Something, I mean, I'm extrapolating on what you said, but this, while I don't see this ever hanging in my home, this is poster worthy.
Yeah. Oh, here's the thing. If you're just saying, I really like this series. And I usually like to have some form of, I've got in my basement, I've got comic book covers framed that are ones that I just really, from series that I really enjoy. And I usually pick a cover that really represents what I liked about it. This, I don't have anything on my wall with Squadron Supreme. If you were to ask me what issue, at least right now, or would you be looking at? This is the one. And actually, I like that the limited series thing's not there because of the color scheme. There's no break in the theming of this one. I know the limited series should be there when you're doing this. I don't have the original issue in front of me. I have the trade in front of me. I'm assuming this is representative of what the original issue was. And I really just think this cover works in every level. It's a good cover.
Yeah. I'm going to jump over you on this for a minute, Gene, and okay. we could still do commentary on it further if you wish. But I'm going to make it really simple. When I rate this thing, I'm giving this book an A+ on every level.
I 100% agree with you. I mean, it's just like I said with the last one, we have a bunch of different plot lines going on as far as the story goes, and the way Gruenwald is handling that is great. Yeah, I agree with you guys on the artwork too. It definitely jumped up. What I find really interesting, I don't know if this was intentional. I'm going to say it was, just because it makes sense. But if you look at the way Dr. Spectrum's face is drawn all through the beginning and in, you know, when he's looking for Nuke and everything, it's kind of your standard superhero-y kind of face. When he gets into the battle, you know, when he's starting to talk to Nuke, you get a little more depth and shading. And then when he's in the battle with Nuke, it's, you know, he's super serious, lots of line work and everything. And then when he can't bring him back, the ultra detailed anguish on him. So he's going from a stereotypical Hal Jordan knockoff to a broken character. And it's all in the artwork. And it is stupendous. So, yeah,
I think you're giving credit for them to have planned this is actually accurate. I don't think that's accidental. I think right. That's absolutely intentional.
Here's another thing that adds to your point about it being an A+. Usually with stories like this, there's that trope of the death of Nuke is the last page.
Mm.
You know, and then the aftermath's the next issue. What I appreciated about this one is that they didn't do that. The death happened. And it wasn't the shock at the end. It was the shock in the story. It fits every one of those pieces. But then they went on and told the aftermath in this issue. I think it's better. The story's better served. It makes me more interested in reading the next issue. Where are they going next? Where is this all going? Mm-hmm. So I think it was an excellent choice. But usually comics have that, especially monthly comics. It's the what are you going to leave them with at the end that's going to make them want to come back next issue? And it is that cliffhanger of what are they going to do now? They did that in this in a different way, because that happens partway through it, not at the very end. And they could have easily plopped it at the end. There's ways you could have reworked this issue very easily to make that happen. And I'm so glad they didn't. I think it's a better issue because of it. It was a really good choice and makes this story feel a little bit different.
You know, very, very minor artistic touch that I just appreciate is at the very end of the story, when Spectrum's telling Nuke's brother about what happened, and they have a close-up of the brother holding his Nuke doll. And the leg is bent in a certain way that it looks like the doll is broken.
Yeah.
And I thought that was just a nice little dramatic touch to it. Doesn't really affect the story. If he hadn't done it that way, it wouldn't lower my artistic grade. Yeah. but it's just, it shows you some of the thought that went into this. And I think that's key. I think the art is rising above the drawings. Even though the drawings, I think, are really, really well done here, because of the excellent storytelling and atmosphere that it's giving us.
This is also the Utopia line of the action figures. When you take a look at all the action figures, they're unmasked.
Yes, yeah, because
it's without the mask, it's Dr. Spectrum without the mask, it's Nuke without the mask. Everybody's unmasked, so they've gone all in. Which I'll be honest with you. Toy companies would absolutely eat this up. And and that wasn't as common back then. And we did not get the amount level of toys that we get today.
Right.
As quickly and responsibly. That's another thing that was cutting edge. I'm like, I don't know if you guys saw a crystal ball as far as what this really looks like now. Toy lines would pump this out right away. And I love that he has the action figures that are the Utopia line of the Squadron Supreme. Without the masks and things. I don't know that they were intending that back at the time, but I really liked that his action figures were more reminiscent of that versus the masked Dr. Spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just 4 years later, we would have Standard Batman, Arctic Batman, Street Racer Batman. all the different costumes. So yeah, this is definitely prescient as far as that goes.
Yeah. Great stuff. So before we wrap things up, is there anything else to add on this? I mean, there's so much quality here. I mean, we probably could break it down panel by panel and spend mm-hmm. another 2 hours going through it, but that's not this show.
No. This is not one of those 6 hour super investigative shows. But now okay, Paul. Much like you with Camelot 3000, I really, really want to read the next issue, but I gotta wait. I gotta wait till we schedule the next recording.
So let's not wait too long to schedule the next recording. And as much as in Camelot 3000, I enjoy the camaraderie of me working with Gene. I think we gain something by adding Sean to the mix.
Yep.
So I think what we're going to try and do when we do issues 4 and 5 is that we add Sean into it, and or we continue to add Sean into it, and the three of us will come back and cover that in the not too distant future.
Yeah, honestly, I greatly enjoyed revisiting this one, so thank you very much for inviting me, guys. This has been a lot of fun.
Well, you noticed that I included you next time without actually asking you if you wanted to come.
Just here's the thread.
you know me well enough. there wasn't a question there.
Very true. So thank you everybody for listening. I hope you're enjoying this. If you haven't picked up these issues or picked up the trade or looked at it on Marvel Unlimited, I mean, it's definitely available to you if you want it. And I can't imagine that you fall into a group that shouldn't want it. You should want this. Mm-hmm. So I'm recommending it highly. And with any luck, when we get to issues 4 and 5, maybe you've already read them and you're going to be able to follow along even more closely with what we say. But thank you again for listening. Thank you guys for doing this with me. It's an absolute pleasure. And we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.